Discussion with Derek, brought to you by Stanlib.
Good morning. Good morning, my Stanlib colleagues, and welcome to the third episode of my regular podcast to all of you. Just a reminder, this is a platform that we use to interview guests from inside and outside of our organization to look at topical burning issues that are relevant to our people at Stanlib, the business and the industry. Today's topic is really something that is quite novel. It's about stress resilience. This is a very topical issue as we sit here today, in that there is concern about the level of stress and how people can cope with their stress situations. And so we've invited a special guest, someone who's got a doctorate in helping people to manage stress resilience. Dr. Mark Oppenlyell is my guest this morning. I'll get a chance to get him to introduce himself. But just very brief heads up about stress resilience, and I'll use a personal story as a runner. And as a runner, you realize that in order to improve and to be able to enjoy the sport that you do, is that you need to get people to be consistent in what you do. You train regularly, you eat, you race, you prepare yourself. But you know that if you don't do these things consistently, you are unlikely to achieve your goals. But the other aspect of it is resilience, which is the ability to bounce back. We all know that at times things don't work out the way that we have planned. Mike Tyson is quoted as saying, everybody has a plan until they got hit by the first punch. And so the question is not whether you've been hit by the first punch, it's a question of whether you can bounce back from that. And so the ability to recover from extreme difficulties introduces a degree of toughness to all of us. And so if there was ever a time for us to talk about resilience, is what we've been through since the beginning of 2020, which seems to be nowhere near ending as we get into 2021. So I'm going to introduce my guest. Dr. Mark Oppenlyell is a registered organization psychologist and also a training consultant. He's got more than 20 years of experience in the corporate world. Listen to this. He completed his PhD in building people's resistance. So this is not a guy who talks about people's resilience. He studied and he's got the proverbial and the required 10,000 hours of deliberate practice in building resilience. As a consultant, he has trained people in resilience all over the world, from neurosurgeons to portfolio managers, ExCo teams, call center operators, basically across the whole spectrum of humanity, he has been helping people to build resilience. Prior to being a consultant, he set up the HR development department at Allen Gray and then ran the organizational department for 11 years. So welcome to Dr. Mark, which are the name I'm going to be referring to. And we really look forward to you giving us a view of how to cope with stress and how we can become a lot more resilient. So Mark, just to kick off, I read in your website that the World Health Organization has declared stress as the health epidemic of the 21st century. But companies that are nurturing the culture of health and of wellness by specifically focusing on well-being of their employees have outperformed the stock market by 300%. So as a leader of an organization, that really both concerns me, but it also makes me excited that by looking at this, we can actually deliver an organization that is performing. But let me go back to you and ask you, what are the mental well-being trends that you are seeing in your consulting practice at the moment?
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, I think there are three key trends that I'm seeing coming through. The one is hyperadaptability, the second is inclusiveness, and the third is burnout and disconnection. I'm just going to quickly unpack each of those three. The first one around hyperadaptability. We can appreciate over the last sort of 10 years, there's been a lot of volatility and uncertainty going on. You just have to think of the water crisis in Cape Town, where we were potentially going to have to queue up to get water. You think about state capture, you think about the rolling blackouts. Apparently, we're going to be having potentially blackouts today. The COVID-19 pandemic, all of these things that have been coming have really created a level of uncertainty and fear and mistrust. And so it's required a huge amount of adaptability for us as South Africans, but also across the world. It's not just unique to South Africans. So that's the first trend. The second one, in terms of inclusiveness, again, you look at around society, what's been happening with the Me Too movement, with Black Lives Matter, Fees Must Fall, LGBTQ plus. People are feeling marginalized, and this has a massive impact on their mental health and on their stress levels. And then the burnout and disconnection. I do a lot of keynote presentations, and I always take the opportunity to survey the audiences that I'm interacting with. And I've got about 550 data points now across the last year, talking to South Africans around the levels of stress that they're experiencing. And on average, I'm seeing that at the high to very high levels of stress, there's 72% of the audience are falling into that category. Now, that has a real impact on in terms of well-being. You have a 43% increased likelihood of dying, increased likelihood of dying when you're in those categories. And then the other question that I tend to ask people is, are you thriving in the four different areas of your life, being your socio-emotional, spiritual, your mental, and your physical? And unfortunately, I get a very woeful response, sitting at around 23% of the audience saying that they're thriving in all of those four areas. So the stats don't really paint a particularly pretty picture around this. And when we look at the pandemic and what's been happening over the last year, year and a half, people on average are working, they reckon, between 1 and 3 hours more per day. Now, there's going to be a price to be paid for this. You mentioned earlier on you're a marathon runner, and you know what happens at the beginning. You're excited, you run hard because you want to get a good time. But if you approach a marathon like it's a sprint, you really pay the price later on. And I think that there's going to be a serious price to be paid for people approaching life like it's a sprint. We really have to have that mentality that it's a marathon. And in fact, I would argue that maybe it's not even a marathon, maybe it's a triathlon. And there's certainly special groups of people that are really experiencing this. I mean, working parents who are juggling the work demands, educating their kids at home online, and then doing their home chores. It's all of these, there's this triple burden, this triple shift burden that people are experiencing. So those are the three broad trends that I'm seeing that is giving rise to increased levels of stress: hyperadaptability, inclusiveness, and burnout and disconnection.
Thanks. I must say that if some of the items that you're saying really resonate with me, in that in the last little while, the sort of observations I've made are, one, people are feeling exposed and quite vulnerable. This has become a situation which is very real. They've seen colleagues being affected, they've seen family members being affected. And so it's really had a very strong personal impact and has left people feeling exposed and vulnerable. At the same time, the degree of uncertainty that all of us have had to deal with and the ever-changing messages around it have made it very difficult for us to discern what is really happening around us and what are the coping mechanisms that would be suitable, and for that matter, how long these coping mechanisms are actually required, because the situation just seems to be incredibly fluid. And so I really feel that a lot of these things are external forces that are impacting on ordinary men and women trying to make a living. And at the same time, they are expected to be performing in environment which, in the business environment, which is incredibly stressful. So I really have a great deal of empathy and sympathy for all of those who are finding themselves having to juggle the environment that we find ourselves in. But Mark, let's go back and talk about stress. Before we talk about exactly what stress is, it would be useful for you to just talk to us about what stress is and what does resilience mean. I also want you to explore the idea of whether there is anything called good stress. In the physical realm, we are told that in order for the body to improve its capacity to cope, it has to have a certain degree of stress, and then that will enable it to adapt. But I'm wondering if, in fact, is that the myth that there's something called good stress, or is it actually something that there's some aspects of stress that one can use to become better?
Okay, great question, Derek. Yeah, you know, they talk about eustress and distress, eustress being positive stress, distress being negative stress. And you know, obviously chronic stress over a long period of time where you're overwhelmed is not going to be helpful. But if you can reframe it, and you can use it as a challenge response, and you can live into that in an effective way, you can harness the power of stress. I think stress, unfortunately, is society's bad boy. And we're constantly told that it's only negative, when in fact, actually, it can help us harness our performance and we can go to higher levels. And in fact, there's this term called post-traumatic growth. I think most of us will have heard about post-traumatic stress disorder, especially being South Africans. But post-traumatic growth is that positive psychological change as a result of going through something stressful or traumatic. And just think about, for all of us, think of those difficult times in our lives. Maybe we had a difficult client or a difficult manager or a difficult situation, and how it revealed certain strengths that maybe we didn't know we had in ourselves, or it made us appreciate our lives differently, or how the world worked, or on a host of different levels. It could have exposed sort of learnings from it. Now, I'm not trying to pretend that those situations were not painful or difficult, but often those difficult situations can really strengthen us if we have the right questions to unlock them. So yes, I think there is good stress and there is bad stress. Good stress, you know, especially where you're choosing that situation where you are living into it. It's something that it's something that you want to be part of. That can be good stress versus negative stress. You know, and you mentioned it earlier on, the pandemic, people losing loved ones, retrenchments. All of those are obviously negative stresses. But let's go back to the basic definitions. And I don't want to get too theoretical, but so I'll just give a very basic definition of what stress and resilience is to my mind. The first one is stress is simply where your demands exceed your resources, where you feel overwhelmed. And when I say resources, I'm not talking here about financial resources, although obviously that creates time, space, and opportunities, and so they are important, but specifically around your coping resources. And the broader your coping resources that you can access, the better. So having a multidimensional approach is really key. And you mentioned earlier on, you know, how this changing dynamic has really stretched us in terms of what coping resources we use. So I think, you know, that's important. The resilience part is an interesting one, because often when I hear people talk about resilience, it's you'll hear people say it's about bouncing back. To my mind, resilience is actually about bouncing forward. And it goes back to that concept that I mentioned earlier on around post-traumatic growth. And it's also not about surviving. I think a lot of people almost have this understanding that resilience is just getting back to where you were. I don't think so. I think it's about thriving. It's about actually operating at a higher level as a result of those difficult situations that you've been through. And we have to develop it proactively. And I think as humans, we need to appreciate that life is tough, it is hard. And if we can proactively develop those skills in advance, we're going to be able to navigate this journey called life so much more effectively. So to my mind, that's really what it's all about. And it is a meta skill. You know, there's going to be so many things thrown at us during the course of our lives. And it's great to have, you know, fantastic analytical or creative thinking skills. But if you're not resilient, you can't bring any of those skills to bear on the situation. So maybe just in terms of, from your perspective, Derek, I mean, how do you see resilience playing out in terms of the leadership? You obviously lead big teams and you've got lots of people reporting through to you. And the impact that has on the people that they lead, what are you noticing in your environments?
Well, I think you make the point about looking forward as opposed to bouncing forward as opposed to bouncing back. And I think for us as leaders, some of the work we need to be doing is constantly looking forward and preempting certain changes that are going to impact our organization and preparing the organization for that. And so I think the ability to message appropriately what we see coming and making sure that the organization doesn't get necessarily negative surprises, or it finds itself in a situation where it's unprepared for what's going to hit it. becomes a very important issue for how the leaders should be preparing organizations and the people who work in them to be able to adapt to what is happening. I think when people are prepared, their chances of adapting and coping are much better than when it is a very big surprise. So that would be the first one, which is really preemptively look at the changes that are coming. I would say also, to some degree, leaders, we need to learn to absorb some of the stress on behalf of the organization. There are stresses which the organization can't cope with, which requires us as leaders to stand in the gap and absorb some of that. And there are others which we need to allow the organization to experience as part of their growth. I would say the final one, Mark, is really questioning whether we've done enough to create a healthy work environment. Some of the stresses that people are dealing with are very much related to the workplace. And therefore, we do need to ask ourselves, what do we need to do to make sure that the workplace, which consume a lot of people's time when they're awake. If you think of a typical individual, there's 24 hours in a day. I would say easily between 8 and 12 of those are consumed with work or work-related interactions. And so if half of that time is unhealthy for the individual, and we as leaders need to be absolutely consumed by actually saying we need to make sure that those 12 hours are quite healthy for the individual so that the individual can thrive. I like the idea of not just surviving, but thriving. Because I think surviving is probably a lesser objective. Thriving means that you are getting better, you are enjoying, you are in the zone. Whereas surviving has got a sense of being a grind in it. Whereas I think thriving is a much more positive experience that one should be pursuing. Certainly, as us leading an organization, we should be looking at how we get people to thrive rather than survive. Mark, I mean, can I ask you a question? Physically, when someone is experiencing stretch, chemically inside them, what is really happening? Okay. Because I know this is not part of the script, but I'm just curious. People talk about chemical changes when you experience stress. I hear terms like melatonin and serotonin, adrenaline, etc., which are all high-powered words. But I'm just trying to figure out, when I'm experiencing stress, what is happening to me physically? Yeah. And why does it take so much out of me that at the end of it, if I don't recover, I'm just wasted, if I can use the term?
Yeah, sure. So you have what's called the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system that's at play. And when you're under stress, your sympathetic nervous system is activated, where you have cortisol and adrenaline and all of those hormones that are secreted so that you can rise to the challenge. Now, in the short term, that's fine because it's getting you ready for the situation. But if it's chronic and it's all the time, it comes with a whole host of baggage with regards to cardiovascular disease, hypertension, etc. And so we need to know how to harness it, but we also need to know how to dissipate it. And that's why, you know, for example, you doing your running is a brilliant way of dissipating some of that those chemical responses. You mentioned a whole lot of things. You know, you mentioned melatonin. Now, melatonin is actually, that's linked to the sleep cycle and when you start feeling tired during the day. And we have these things called circadian rhythms, which they're our biological clock that's operating behind the scenes all the time. Mm-hmm. And many people are actually out of sync with their circadian rhythm. They're doing things at the wrong time in the day relative to where the peak times are. So, for example, you and I, we're both morning people, and we function well early in the morning. Mm-hmm. But come sort of 7, 8 in the evening, you and I have to do this because I've got clients in San Francisco in America, I'm a bit of a zombie. And my best thinking is not happening at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. So we need to be aware of those circadian rhythms. There's a whole huge interplay. You know, you mentioned serotonin, and we've got endorphins. Endorphins often are released in your runner's high, which is a painkiller. All those neurotransmitters, they interact with each other in a very complex way. And I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not going to, you know, give you all of the medical doctoral sort of background on that. But we need to know about this, we need to understand them, and we need to harness them because they have a massive impact to play in terms of our health and our levels of happiness and mood and attention, etc.
I see. Well, that's quite useful. At least we know that physically, as we go through stress situation, there are some chemicals, etc., that enable us to cope. But if they are there almost like a semi-permanent basis, it becomes a destructive situation
Correct.
for our health. All right. But if you're reading now, Mark, out of your data points are saying that people are generally stressed, why are people experiencing more stress? Are we just a generation that all of a sudden are unlucky and we're experiencing more stress? Or are there unique circumstances that we're dealing with which seems to elevate the level of stress?
Yeah, I think every generation probably has its challenges. I mean, if you were sitting in World War II, there were some significant stresses during World War II, life-threatening situations. But if I take it to where we are currently, I think there are three key things that really strike me. And the one is a very current one in terms of the fear of unemployment. You look in the South African context, the official rate is sitting at around, what, 32.5%, probably a lot higher. And especially for the youth, it's even higher than that. So that very real fear of unemployment, I think, really drives interesting behaviors, but sometimes quite destructive behaviors. I think one of the things I've noticed is people are overcompensating. They're running incredibly hard because they want to be seen as good corporate citizens. They don't want to lose their jobs. It's a very understandable reaction. But as I said earlier on, that sprint mentality is going to come back to bite you later on because we're in a marathon, we're not in a sprint. And then also, the whole thing with retrenchments, the natural knock-on effect when we have retrenchments is that people are expected to do more with less, which ultimately obviously increases the workload and makes it harder for people to deliver. So that's the first one as a trend. The other one is an uncertain future. And I think you mentioned it earlier on. We're not sure what the next 18 months, 2 years holds for us. And look, no generation had a crystal ball, but there seemed to be more stability in the past than there is now. And I think that for people is very unsettling from that perspective. And then COVID, I mean, let's be honest, the frequency and the intensity and how people have lost loved ones close to them, lost people in their workplace, is so much more acute than what we've typically experienced in our life cycles. And so that is obviously very intense, but it's also come with other interesting dynamics. So, for example, social isolation. Now, we have to do physical distancing. I totally get that as a principle. But we know that when people are socially isolated, that has a very negative impact on their mental health. And so that's negative. But then there's also this thing on grief. And an interesting term that I came across recently is this idea around disenfranchised grief. When you lose somebody that we care about, oh, that's natural grief. You'd understand why a person would be grieving. But what about all the little things that we've lost? For example, in the last year, you couldn't run marathons with groups of other people. You couldn't run with your running club the way that you used to run. My daughter this year, she's meant to be having a matric dance, and she's been looking forward to that for years. She can't do that. Now, she's not going to complain, and I'm sure you're not complaining about the fact that you weren't running with your friends. But that disenfranchised grief, it kind of sits in the system, and we feel like we're missing out and we're losing out on things, but we're not really going to talk about it because relative to people losing their lives, it's not seen as that important. But it hurts, There's a pain that comes with that. And I think that also feeds into why people are feeling more stressed, around it.
So let's just shift gears and get to the idea of what people refer to as burnout, which we're told is really becoming a reality. How's the tendency to strive for perfectionism at the same time managing workaholic behaviors exacerbating people's stress experience? I also want you to deal very briefly with the idea of working from home. Is that turning us into workaholics?
Yeah, well, I mean, let me start with that question, then I'll work back to the burnout and the workaholism. I think in the past we had natural boundaries for many of us, not everybody. Some people work from home or anywhere, but for many of us, it's a new dimension. And so the boundaries between work and home now have collapsed onto each other. People don't have rituals; they kind of work longer because of this pandemic. They're operating in a sprint mentality, and unfortunately, that working from home has created that sort of dynamic. Yes, people are more productive. It's interesting. The results are showing that there has been an uptick in terms of performance for most people, not everybody, because sometimes you've got things like connectivity issues, or maybe your work environment doesn't set up that way, or you're a new person, you don't know how work flows and who you're connected with. But on average, people are being more productive, but they're working longer. And so I think the work from home is an interesting one because there are definite pluses and there are also definite minuses that have kind of come through. But it's interesting, this idea around workaholism and perfectionism. Many organizations recruit for that. You know, we look for those people that are incredibly hardworking and that set very high standards. And in fact, I come from an asset management industry environment, and you have to do that to get ahead. You can't just do the bare minimum. We know that. It's a competitive world out there. So I'm not saying let's have low standards or anything like that. But I'm talking about when it's excessive, because for many of us, we've got this idea that, you know, work hours and high standards, it's this linear sort of progression upwards, and it just keeps on going upwards and it's positive. But there comes a point where there's a topping out and it plateaus. In fact, it becomes negative. And I'm talking about excessive workaholism and excessive perfectionism. And those two often drive people into burnout zone. So I call them the three amigos, but it's the perfectionism and workaholism that often drives that. And we know, for example, you know, let's take workaholics. They have 2 to 3 times as likely to experience depression or anxiety than the normal population. They don't get, workaholics don't get higher performance appraisal ratings than people who work hard. That's what the research has shown. There was a meta study done in 2016. But also we know that ultimately the workaholic will burn out. Because they're not looking after the health, they're not looking after their relationships. And ultimately, that's going to impact their presenteeism, their absenteeism, all of those key factors, because the team is going to have to pick up the pieces at some stage and take over. But the thing that shocked me the most was it's not even just linked to the workplace. Children of workaholics experience higher levels of depression than children of non-workaholics. So it has this ripple effect across all of the different levels of society. But, you know, the other thing, perfectionism, a lot of people say, well, how on earth could perfectionism be bad? But when we think about excessive perfectionism, there's some interesting things here. You know, excessive perfectionists feel the need to advertise their perfection, and they like to be very critical of other people. So they really kind of break the team morale. Secondly, they avoid situations where perfection isn't possible. So this results in often chronic procrastination. And we know business is time sensitive. We've got to get things out, yes, at the right standard. But that can be a real issue. And then thirdly, they're often going to hide or not disclose situations where they've been imperfect, which then doesn't allow us the opportunity to actually correct the situation. So they'll conceal those errors. So those two things that we often laud and support and recruit for in organizations can come back to bite us in quite negative ways as well.
Mark, just to digress a bit, how do people, if I'm an individual, how do I know that I'm heading towards burnout? What are the signals that I should be watching for to make sure that I don't that I can at least self-contain my chances of actually getting into burnout? You talk about being an excessive perfectionist. So I think that's a useful one, which is I really want to get everything right perfectly all the time, and I'm willing to take long, etc. I'm not willing to have accept 80% as good enough. I always want it to be perfect. So that's one characteristic. Are there other characteristics that we should be aware of that when we start seeing them, we should start saying to ourselves, this type of behavior could lead to what they're not?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Derek. Burnout is such an overused word in society. You often hear people very glibly kind of say, oh, I'm burnt out on that. And I always like, are you really burnt out or are you just tired? Yeah. But there are three kind of key dimensions of burnout that we have that have to all coexist at the same time to be burnt out. The first one is that emotional and physical exhaustion, that real sort of sense of absolute tiredness. And it's not like you have a long weekend and you recover and then you're fine. It's just pervasive. You just feel like low energy. And that's the obvious part of burnout that most of us think about. But the next two are also very important. The next one is around cynicism. It's where you no longer see the human being on the other side of that interaction as a human being. You just see them as another transaction, and it really changes the nature of the way that you do your work. And so cynicism is incredibly detrimental to exceptional client service, etc. And then the last one is professional efficacy, where you no longer doubt, where you do doubt your capabilities to do the job, where you've lost confidence in your ability to do it. Now, that's not a training issue, by the way. You used to be able to do it, and now you don't believe that you can do it. And when those three exist together, that's when I definitely recommend that you go and chat to a psychologist, because before that you get there, because once you get proper burnout, it takes a long time to unwind out of it. So you want to really proactively manage it. And the best way to proactively manage it is to invest in the four different areas of your life, your mental, your physical, your spiritual, and your socio-emotional. And when I say spiritual, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about purpose in life. Although obviously for certain people, religion can be a massive wellspring of resilience. But those four, when you have a multifaceted approach, they're your best antidotes to burnout.
Mm. Mark, do you mind just spending a bit more time talking about recovery from burnout? You made a statement that it takes a long time for people to recover from burnout. What is a long time? If I've sort of been working myself to death for an extended period of time, say a year or two, is it a month for me to recover from burnout? Does someone just pour cold water on me, give me a few claps on the face, and tell me, get up, get on with it, and then I'm back to where I am, or it's longer? And what are the things that people need to do to recover from burnout?
Yeah, well, great question. So, there's not a magic number, Derek. I wish I could say, take this pill and in 2 weeks' time you're going to be fine.
I thought you'd say there's an app for it.
For a special price, I'll tell you what it is. No, unfortunately, it's actually, it's incredibly serious, and it takes a long time, many months, potentially, for people to unravel this. And sometimes years. And often it needs help in the sense of finding a healthcare professional, somebody who understands this, who can challenge the way that you think about things and create some sort of life plan for you so that you can unravel some of the things that have got you back into that space. But that's the one part. And I think we talked about it earlier on. The other part, Derek, is for us as organizational leaders to acknowledge that, hold on, if we're noticing this as a trend in our organization, what are we doing to take some of that noise out? Because it's not just on the individual. We have to be focusing on the organization and saying, what's unnecessary noise? There's always going to be stress. That's a reality. I mean, any high-performing organization is going to have stress built in, and that's actually fine. I call it dynamic tension. But when it's excessive, when it's unrealistic in terms of, and it's overwhelming for people, and we use people as cannon fodder, that's on us as organizational leaders. And that's when we've got to really say, hold on, what are we going to do differently going forward? And I think that's going to be a crucial part of this. Otherwise, we've been very simplistic and just putting all the pressure on the individual to solve the problem.
Good. I think that's a good drift to what we as leaders in the organization, what we should be doing to nurture a culture of health and well-being and really set up our employees for success. And I also want you to just talk about very briefly around what are the signs that we should be looking for in our organization that indicate that we might have a problem. Are there specific data points that one should be looking and watching? And as you see them, that's telling you that either you have an organization that is healthy or you have an organization that is toxic.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the first things that I would suggest to you, Derek, is to lead with data, because every organization's context is different. As much as there are certain environmental variables that are universal to all of us in South Africa, each company's got its own unique challenges. So exploring those data points, whether it's looking at the absenteeism, whether it's looking at presenteeism, I don't know if you know this, but presenteeism is 10 times more costly than absenteeism. And that's when, people are at work, but the lights are not on. They're not engaged, they're not motivated to do their best work. So understanding what engagement levels are. Looking at chronic illness, looking at the discovery, well, not discovery, it depends on what your medical aid provider is, but looking at what those chronic illnesses are. All of these things can give us a view of what's going on in terms of independent data points and then making our plans accordingly. But really looking at it holistically, don't just look at the physical indicators, which is often where organizations focus, but look at the mental health issues as well around that. So I think that's one of the key points that you should do from an organizational perspective. But The first thing to my mind is stop thinking about this, that, for example, health day as a one day a year sort of event, and then tick the box and we've done it. I think really we have to regard this as an everyday issue. And context is king, and that's where we need that data. The second thing I'd like to challenge HR, OD departments, senior leadership with is that stress is a soft issue. It's not a soft issue. It's actually a very real bottom line consequence. You know, in South Africa, for example, Lund School of Economics did a study in 2016 where they found that 40% of all workplace-related illnesses can be linked to work-related stress. That's huge. You know, so we are creating sometimes those toxic environments, and it has a massive bottom line impact. In fact, organizations with highest resilience scores have 3.7 times higher return on equity annually. That was a study that was done by BetterUp that showed those numbers. So this is not a soft issue. It's a hard issue because it affects us financially as organizational leaders. The third point is build all employees, and I'm talking about both staff and managers, resilience capability. It is a meta skill. In fact, my initial research started with actuaries, and CAs, but predominantly with actuaries. And they're super smart. These are people that are really intelligent. But IQ is not a protective blanket for stress. In fact, often because they're so perfectionistic, like we mentioned earlier on, they're more prone to experiencing burnout. And so you can have the best analytical, the best creative skills in the world, but if you don't have resilience, you can't bring those to bear. So it's a meta skill that I think we need to teach everybody. And then the fourth point, and we've kind of been alluding to it during the course of today's presentation, is really to teach leaders and managers how to create resilient systems, because they are system architects. And what I mean by that is to think at three levels, at an individual level. How can I lead by example? Because when I lead by example, that has a trickle-down effect to everybody else. In fact, BetterUp looked at this in terms of resilient leaders versus staff members, and they found that staff members of resilient leaders were 2.7 times greater resilience, 52% less burnout, and 78% lower intention to leave the organization. So when I lead by example, I have that impact on the people below me. We also need to look at the teams. And again, how do we as leaders create teams where there's psychological safety, where people have a voice, where they can speak up, where they can raise their concerns, put half-baked ideas out there so that people can discuss them and brainstorm. And then finally, the organization, you know, talking about creating an ecosystem where, yes, dynamic tension exists, but let's get rid of the unnecessary noise, the things that are not helpful, that are distracting and pushing people into burnout. And when we teach leaders how to lead like that, we're creating a resilient system. I work across the industry, across most of the financial services organizations. And what I've noticed is that in each of those different organizations that I interact with, there's no one specific company that's got all of the talent. In most of those organizations, we've got exceptional talent. But what I do notice is the systems that we create around the people is very different. And some unlock potential and others inhibit potential. And we really need to bear that in mind. So to my mind, you know, there will always be stress. It's not the enemy per se, but we need to take both individual responsibility for our own mental health, but also collective action. Mm-hmm. In doing so, we create sustainable systems that are human-centered, that are purpose-driven organizations, that ultimately ensure great experiences for our clients. I think that's what we should be aiming for.
Great. Quite clearly, there's all kinds of ideas floating around about stress and how we should manage it. I'd like you to just talk about the bad advice that you have had about how people should be managing stress, and what are the sort of myths that are floating around how people should be managing stress.
No, great question. And hopefully, Derek, you're also going to share some of yours, because I'm sure as you moved through the ranks into senior management, you were given some advice. And in retrospect, you probably thought, oh, that didn't work for me at all. But I think there are four key ones. The first one is just ignore it. A lot of people just say, oh, well, just put it in the back of your mind. But I don't believe that's the right approach. I think we've got to be proactive. We've got to identify what's going on, and we've got to take action. And be careful of dealing with the superficial symptoms. We've got to make those plans and then work on it. Avoiders, we know people who avoid stress actually have higher levels of stress than people that are proactive copers. The second one is don't think about the past, just look forwards. I hear a lot of people issue that mantra. And that's dangerous because if you think about it, what is wisdom? Wisdom is the ability to reflect on our experiences, to grow from them and learn from them. And if we never reflect on them, you don't want to live in the past. That's not helpful. That's rumination. But you've got to be able to reflect on the past and then learn from those lessons. And that's where, you know, I mentioned post-traumatic growth earlier on. I'm not saying go out and find difficult situations. Don't worry, life will find you. But when those situations happen, we need to be able to introspect onto them and say, well, what have I learned from those situations? The third piece of advice that I find not helpful is have no regrets. Remember, psychopaths don't have regrets or remorse. So, you know, sometimes it's good to have some regrets in certain things that we do. But I think a better way of looking at it is to really live consciously, to know what we want out of our life, and then to go and make it a reality. And when we close that gap between our expectations and our reality, but in a positive way, not dumbing down our expectations, I think that's a much better place to be in. And then the one that I often hear is fake it till you make it. I don't know. Maybe it's I spend too much time in asset management and I deal with people who like to deal with real things. But to my mind, I think it's better to play into your strengths. Identify what your strengths are, and then experience that virtuous loop where success begets success. So find whatever those strengths are and work on those. And in a similar vein, you know, cultivate realism. The reality that we face is so important for us to see both the upside and the downside. If we only focus on it's all going to be Hollywood endings and unicorns and sunshine. You know, we're naively optimistic, and it doesn't always play out like that. But also, if we're pervasively pessimistic and we're only looking at the negative, we miss out on some of those opportunities. And I think it's important that we can hold both of those in our mind and then mitigate for the risk. You know, think about the downside and how we can make plans. And to my mind, that's a more balanced perspective. That's what we should be aiming for. Those are four pieces of advice, I think, that ultimately don't help.
Yeah, I'll add two that I've been exposed to. The first one is suck it up, and the other one is a bit of a tricky one, because it's usually said in the most it's supposed to encourage you, but I'm not sure that it's helpful. Is these two shall pass, which really just says that, you know what, you don't have to do anything, just sit there and wait for it to pass. And so those are the two which I see as probably bad advice that I've received around managing stress. So as we get towards the end of the podcast, Mark, let's talk about make it practical, which is, okay, now what should we be doing to enhance, first of all, our own individual stress resilience, and for us as leaders, what should we be doing to build our people's resilience?
Yeah, so I think, again, going back to, remember that initial scary stat that I mentioned, around 23% of people are thriving in all four areas of our lives. It's to understand what are our own current audit scores. So if we analyzed our spiritual, our socio-emotional, mental, and physical, and we did a little audit and evaluated how we're doing in each of those dimensions, that just gives us an initial starting point to say, okay, this is maybe where I need to focus on. And then build very simple action plans. I think often what happens is people try to change too much in their lives, and then they end up changing nothing at all. So find something simple that you can repeat over a regular basis and build that snowball sort of effect. But let's take each one of those, and I'll just give you some practical ideas, but then there's literally thousands that can attach to each of them. So under mental fitness, build practices that encourage a state of flow where you've really focused on the task at hand. I believe in today's society, we've got so much fragmented attention. You know, we get locked into our cell phones and our Twitter feeds and our emails and all of these different distractions, and we can't harness the power of our minds to focus on the problems at hand. And so if we can get into that state of flow, which is that optimal state of performance, that's really important. And this is not just for us as individuals, organizations. We have to think about, you know, how can we support this? So, for example, do we have meeting-free Mondays or no email Thursdays? Or do we have servers that close down after a certain time so that people can't be emailing each other? There are lots of different things that companies are exploring at the moment to look at this fragmented attention that's given rise as a result of technology. Now, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying that, you know, technology is incredibly helpful on many levels, but we need to know how to manage it. It mustn't manage us. So I think the state of flow is really important. And the socio-emotional fitness, I think building that psychological safety, which is really around interpersonal risk-taking, if we can build a home base, and when I say home base, I'm inverted home base, inverted commas home base, it's about relationships in the workplace. As you said, we spend so much time at work. And if we're constantly looking at over our shoulders and we feel like somebody's going to stab us between our shoulder blades, that's a terrible place to be because we're constantly going to be in a hyper state of arousal. So building that. And how do we do that? You know, how do we create psychological safety? I do a lot of work in this space. And some of the key things that come to mind is inclusive leadership. So leaders who know how to bring people into the team. Building genuine team trust. And this is not about, you know, having another amazing race or pointy course competition and things like that. I love fun. I think those are all nice, but they don't really build that deeper level of trust in individuals. And how do we build that trust? Identifying what the toxic behavior is and what is the pro-social behavior and drawing a line in the sand around that and saying, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. Creating safe space platforms where people can share their concerns, whether it's the way that we have retrospectives or pre-mortems or whatever, or how we handle meetings. And then handling failure, because the reality is that part of business is always is going to be an element of failure, even when you're in a high-performing organization. But how do we handle that in a way that's constructive? And then lastly, but not least, and it's a golden thread that runs throughout the whole of psychological safety, is how do we have conversations that count? I saw a fascinating piece of research that said that having difficult conversations at work is more stress-invoking for people than breaking up with somebody in terms of your personal life. So we're less inclined to want to have that conversation at work than breaking up with somebody in our personal life, which seems extremely weird. So that's under the socio-emotional. And then under the physical fitness, and I know you got this well covered because you went for a run this morning, but, you know, have fun. So many people, when they approach exercise, it's a chore. They do it because they know it's good for them, but they don't really enjoy it. Find what you enjoy doing and have fun. That's going to make it a lot easier. But also aim for variety. We really need to build variety in because the different kinds of exercise impact our brains differently and our physical structure. So have cardiovascular, have flexibility, have strength training. They're all key components of our health. And then last but not least, in terms of that, have walking meetings, you know, coaching sessions, you know, obviously we've got to be careful with social distancing and the third wave and all of that, but, you know, don't just sit down all the time. We're too sedentary. Build in exercise into your daily routine. And then spiritual fitness, I think this is the crucial one for me here, is about identifying what a purpose-driven life looks like. And I talk about the trifecta. I developed this concept of the trifecta, which talks to the purpose, which is answers that why question. Why are you here? And all of us have at some stage in our lives pondered this question, but we need to really engage with it, have that North Star. Then the second part of the trifecta is the code, which is really about as you navigate towards that North Star, that purpose, how are you going to live your life and for whom? You know, who are the people that you want to make that contribution to? And then the third part of the trifecta is the goals, which was really answering the what, the where, and the when. And that breathes life into the previous two components of your code and your purpose statement. And when you have that trifecta, you have this amazing ability to deal with what life throws at you. If you've got a big enough why, you can almost survive any what. And that was one of the key findings from Viktor Frankl, who was one of the seminal psychiatrists of the 20th century, came up with. And he came up with that insight when he was sitting inside a concentration camp in the Holocaust. And so it's an incredible, powerful insight that we need to think a little bit about for our own lives. And for me, those three things, have a multifaceted approach will really help you have a well-lived life, but also be able to be really resilient.
Right. That's fantastic, Mark. Thank you. I think that the trifecta that you refer to sounds like a very useful framework that one could use, and we certainly would benefit from having access to that framework for us as an organization, on for that matter, for anybody listening to us. Thank you. All right, so we're coming to the end of our session this morning on stress resilience. Just to share my own thoughts about it. One of the questions that I do get asked is, what do I do to manage the pressures of my role? Just to let you in into my thinking, my practices are, one, I'm very much influenced by some of the Greek philosophers who had an aphorism that says, know thyself. When you're sort of over 50, you tend to be a lot more familiar with the things that work for you and the things that don't work for you. And so I've invested a meaningful amount of time to understand myself better. Some of it has been feedback from other people. Some of it has been experience and mistakes I've made. And some of them have been positive experiences I've made to get to know myself. And knowing myself means that I, for instance, know very well that if I've got a particular difficult decision I need to make, it's better to do it in the morning because I'm a morning person. By late afternoon, early evening, I'm really exhausted and I'm not in a position to apply myself. And the level of stress and of enjoyment that I have at that point in time is probably at its lowest. And so that's one of the ways, which is really picking the big decisions that need to be made and making sure that I'm making them at the time that is best suited for me as an individual. I'm very different. My sons, who are teenagers, are owls. They really come alive in the early evening. That's the best time for them as opposed to me. The second issue is really I've gotten to know what are the trigger events, what are the type of things that seems to induce a lot more stress, and how do I manage around that? Some of them you have to avoid because you just know that it will overwhelm me. Others is very much about preparation and asking other colleagues to help you where you feel that you are short. If you've got a very aggressive situation that you need to manage, maybe you need to get another colleague who's aggressive who can manage that, and you be the peacemaker, as opposed to being front and center of the battle. So knowing really what are the trigger events that get me off. The final one is really the quality of my sleep. There is no doubt that as our current generation, we are all chronically short of sleep. All the evidence that's coming out from research on sleep is that it is a fantastic restorative drug for all of us. And unfortunately, we don't seem to utilize that. So I'm a lot more disciplined on sleep and the quality of sleep. I'm very fanatical about going to bed at a set time and getting up in the morning around a set time and making sure that I'm getting not only the number, the quantity of hours of sleep right, but also the quality. And the quality is a lot more, I'm a lot more finicky about it. Not only just the mattress that I use, which I've invested in it, is probably one of the most expensive things I have in my house. It's not the flat TV screen, it's actually the mattress that I use. And then finally, just making sure that the ambience, etc., in the room that I sleep is conducive to that. And those are the disciplines that have helped me to manage and to cope with stress. And obviously, I'm adding a lot more. I certainly will take some of the stuff that you've talked about here, particularly the spiritual fitness side. And also just enhancing my connections with other people. To my audience, thank you for joining me again this morning. We are getting a lot of interest in this podcast, and we're getting some ideas about what else we should be addressing. And you're more than welcome to send ideas to us, and we'll make sure that we find guests who are very knowledgeable, as you've seen today with Dr. Mark Lydon. Talk about the issues that we are not so familiar with. So thank you and goodbye, and we'll see you in another month's time. And again, many thanks to my guest for this morning. Dr. Mark, you have a good day.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you.
In discussion with Derek, brought to you by Stanlib.